Okay, so I thought we could start today with a fun topic. All our topics are fun, but more explicitly fun than how we ordinarily start off necessarily, which is, Steve, a while back, a couple weeks back, you sent a text to our group, and it was something online that said, could you beat a random American in a 1 mile race with your life on the line? I'm curious how you found this, which we can get into in a second, what you were doing online to come to this. Maybe someone emailed it to you. But the prompt is, a random American is selected. It could be anyone from your gran to Grant Fisher. Don't know who Grant Fisher is, so Steve, you also have to educate me on that. Whoever it is, you must race them in the mile on the track. If you beat them, you get $1 million. If you lose, however, you die. Do you take the challenge?
Man, I'm everything running finds me. So it came across on Twitter. I forget what runner tweeted it, but somebody did. Grant Fisher is the American record holder in the 5K and the 10K. He's basically, you know, America's best distance runner. So clearly,
Brad,
that
did
up.
You know that? No, Brad did not know that.
I had no idea. I assume that Grant Fisher was someone fast based on the prompt, at least someone faster than my grandparent.
Let's hope so. All right. Well, all the runners and coaches are screaming at us and just being like, what are you guys doing? But that's why I'm here. So I think it's interesting because to me, and Brad will give his take, but to me, at certain periods of my life, I'm like, oh, this is a no-brainer, because you're looking at, you know, anybody in America, and I've got, I don't know, at my best, you know, we'll go back to high school, Steve, maybe 30, 40, 50 Americans who could beat me at that point. I like those odds out of 350 million or 300 million or what have you. Like, I'll risk my life. And, you know, Brad brought up a good thing, which is that, hey, what happens if you tear your Achilles or pull your hamstring or what have you? Honestly, I still like my odds, because if you're a newsletter subscriber, you'll hear how 2 weeks after a strained hamstring, or you'll have read 2 weeks after a strained hamstring, I ran the equivalent of about a 405 mile. And then on an Achilles tear, literally the Achilles was partially torn off the bone, I closed a half marathon in 4:30. So feel like life on the line, unless I'm matched up with Grant Fisher, I'm going to take that $1 million.
You kind of hedged. You said that when you were in peak fitness, and the question was now.
So if you give me 3 months.
Nope. Now. Today. The drawing in the race happens today. That is the question.
Yeah, but that's like, I'm in like dad mode, you know?
Right. But you're still what? A 4:45 miler with a gun to your head right now?
I'd probably run 4:30 gun to my head.
Yeah. So let's be real. Are there that many people in between 4:18 and 4:30 or whatever you think you'd get down to?
Yeah. I mean, yeah. You're taking it from, let's put it like this. Let's say if you give me 3 months, I could, you know, and it was gun to my head, I could probably get in 4:10-ish shape with super spikes. You know, you're looking at 4:10-ish, maybe Americans, maybe 500, 600, you know, total. If you're looking at 4:30, now you're including a bunch of random high school kids. Like, you're looking at maybe a couple thousand. Changes the odds pretty significantly.
So you would have said yes to this, no question, 18, 19, 20, right?
And I would say yes to this if I was healthy at any time between, you know, 16 and we'll say 30, 35.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Brad, I'm going to guess this is a no for you.
Of course it's a no. And it would probably be a no even if I had Steve's fitness, because the tail end risk that you pull Grant Fisher and you lose is the end of your life. And I enjoy being alive. There's big value in that. I thought Steve, when he said that Brad brought up a good point, which thank you, Steve. You don't say that often, so I'll take it when you do. I thought you were going to mention the other point that I brought up around skin in the game differentials when it comes to probabilistic thinking. So this comes from Nassim Taleb, statistician, author of many books, and he's mostly known for this concept of anti-fragility, but he also has done a whole bunch of mathematical work on what he calls skin in the game. And essentially what he says is that when these psychologists run experiments based on probability, i.e., you know, there's a 0.000001% chance that you draw someone that's faster than Steve. Well, it's pretty easy to do an expected value calculation and make your bet. And the bet there is like, you're going to win. But when you actually have skin in the game, like when your ass is the one that's going to die, suddenly you no longer think about probability based on rational expected values. You hedge against what Taleb calls far right of the bell curve or black swan events. So here, I would argue that like the cost of losing if you value your life is infinite. So therefore, any expected value is going to be negative. So I think that the answer is no for me. And I hope it's no for Steve, because I like Steve here. When you were like the, 10th fastest runner in America, then it probably, I still wouldn't do it, but I would forgive you for doing it. But otherwise, I just don't see how anyone makes that bet who currently has enough financial resources to live a decent quality of life that they enjoy.
I mean, I hear you, but again, my perspective is if I'm looking at odds of 40 to 350 million, I like the odds. And even in those 40, like, you know, probably 20 of those, I got shot at beating on a good day. So I like the odds, you know. My odds of dying are probably higher going to, you know.
Wow, good point.
Take a road.
That's a good point.
Taking a trip or.
You sound like Alex Honnold now. It's exactly what he said when I interviewed him a few years ago. All right. Clay, I'm curious how you think about it. And then I'm also curious, and we don't need to give this too much more time, but let's say that with a gun to my head, i.e. death, I could run an 8-minute mile right now. Runners, don't laugh. I mean, do we think that there's over 1 million people that can run an 8-minute mile? Because if not, I still have like a 99.66% chance of winning the bet.
Yeah, that's what's crazy. I probably right now could run comfortably. I could run 5. So gun to my head, I think I could probably run 4:45.
Damn, so I don't know you're that fast, Clay.
The problem here is the $1 million, I think. If it was $50 million or $20 million, maybe not 20, but north of $30 million, plus added with the percentage chance that I would win at the fitness I'm at right now, is I think that is a combination that I would take that.
That is a good point. I think if you inflated it enough, like, you know, it's worth the risk because the odds are so small.
Unless you value your life at infinity, in which case it's never worth the risk. But what it sounds like is that you guys would both be comfortable putting a monetary value on your life.
And now that I said I could run a 5-minute mile, I'm like, could I? I'm not sure.
You said with comfort.
So, I got faith.
Yeah, not comfortable. Not comfortable. Runner's comfortable, if you know what I mean.
I got faith in you, Clay.
I'll tell you the one person I wouldn't want to run against, which is Grant Fisher, because obviously he's going to be pissed once he listens to this, because he's obviously a listener of the show and realizes that 2/3 of the growth equation doesn't know who he is.
he's gonna rig the competition to make sure he finds you, Clay, for this when it happens in the next Squid Game competition that occurs when we're all in a post-doc apocalyptic scenario after 2024.
Second big order of today. The New York Times exercise IQ quiz. We will put this in the show notes so you guys can take this really quick. It's 12 questions. It shouldn't take you more than 5 minutes, I wouldn't imagine. If it's taking you longer than 5 minutes, you might be putting a little too much effort into it. But the prompt says, few things are more important to your overall health and longevity than exercise, but getting started can feel overwhelming. How much do you really have to exercise? Should you stretch it first? And what the heck is a burpee anyway? Let's start with the basics. So the three of us took this quiz. I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, I believe Steve did the best, 11 out of 12. Brad was 10 out of 12. I was 9 out of 12. So I think one more missed out, you guys would have to fire me. But I'm just curious what you guys, what your overall experience of taking this quiz was. I will say that I was kind of, I don't know. I was, this will lead into our bigger conversation, which is about wellness and fitness and how it's gotten overcomplicated. But I was sort of struck, and this sounds maybe a little condescending or elitist, by how basic these questions are. And yet I got 3/4 of them wrong. So.
Yeah, I'll go first here. My overall take is it's dumb and it's stupid and it's clickbait and it's a race to the bottom. And it's really frustrating to see, you know, the New York Times spending so much production time on an exercise quiz where 10 out of the 12 questions are utterly meaningless. The most important one, they got the answer wrong. Like, not us, but the New York Times got the answer wrong.
Which one was that?
The one about what's a better indicator of improving fitness, your mile time or your heart rate.
So is that the one we all got wrong? Because I got that wrong.
Well, no, but we got it right. The New York Times got it wrong. Any exercise scientist, including Steve, will tell you that it is the mile time, not your heart rate, that is a better increase, or excuse me, a better indicator of fitness. I mean, it's such a falsifiably stupid question. You take anyone that's in decent shape whose heart rate is already like towards its genetic most fit, they can still get faster when they get more fit, but their heart rate's not going to get lower. And at a certain point, your heart rate actually becomes too low, and that's not a sign of health or fitness. So it was just a really misguided question. And then I'll stop ranting, but the other one was like on dynamic stretching. And the New York Times thought that they were being like all spiffy by being like, ooh, the answer is not static stretching, it's dynamic stretching. But there's zero good evidence for dynamic stretching before a workout either. You know what you should do before you train is your warm-up? Whatever makes you feel good. And if that is some striders, it's some striders. If that's static stretching, static stretching. If it's leg swings, it's leg swings. If it's going to the gym and starting with a barbell, it's a barbell. If it's foam rolling, it's foam rolling. But like, none of these interventions have any solid research. Correct me if I'm wrong, Steve, that they actually make a difference. You should just do what makes you feel good. So that was an example of false precision. And then the one about what should you do to prevent knee pain? And the answer was swimming. I picked swimming because none of the other ones made any sense. Like, swimming was the least of the terrible choices. But like, show me the evidence that swimming is among the gold standard. Like, there's so many things you could do that are better than swimming for preventing knee pain that weren't on that list, starting with like walking. So I rest my case.
Oh man. Thanks, Brad. Where do I start? I guess first, the only caveat I'll have on the static stretching is there is plenty of research that shows if you're trying to go sprint, that static stretching right before would hamper your performance. So don't do that. Sprint, power, et cetera, et cetera. But everything else, spot on. I think the other question that came in that really bothered me, I mean, I got it right because I knew what they were thinking, but it's such a dumb answer, was that how often should a regular runner get new shoes? And they gave these options: every 2 years, every 6 months, every 1,000 miles, as soon as your toes poke out the front. It's so dumb because like, it depends on how much you run for those first two. If every 6 months, which was their correct answer, if I followed that in high school, I would literally put like 10,000 miles on my shoes. They wouldn't exist. They would be done. I would say out of those answers, the most correct is every 1,000 miles, because as I explained to you, when I was in high school running 100-mile weeks, my parents refused to buy me shoes every month because that's what you were supposed to be doing. So I stretched them to 1,000 miles. The real answer, generally rule of thumb, every 300, 500 miles. So that one bothered me because, again, it was wrong, even though, you know, I knew the right answer. And then the heart rate versus mile time, man. Ugh. It so bothered me because, like, I clicked mile time, got it wrong, and then clicked on heart rate to see their explanation. And it goes into resting heart rate, you know, can give you some, or can give you a good idea of cardiovascular fitness. And it just so happened that, you know, that same day yesterday, I was reading through a very old study on some of history's first sub 4-minute milers. And people like Roger Bannister and others who broke the barrier first, and all of them had very low resting heart rates, some down to 32, most in the 40s, except for my man, Daryl Burleson, who was one of the first Americans. His heart rate was sitting at like, his resting heart rate was sitting at 68. One of the best runners in the world. You know, won many national championships. One of the first guys to ever break four. According to New York Times, not very fit, man. But the point is, like, this is the absurdity of some of these things when we simplify things so much. And I think we do people a disservice when we simplify things to say, hey, the answer is, like, you know, go swim if you have knee pain. It's like, no. Like, exercise is a little more complicated. People can be trusted to understand a little bit of nuance besides, like, do this exact exercise and it will solve all your problems. And I think that's why, one of the reasons why people get so confused in the health and fitness world, because they see stupid answers that say, you know, eggs are the best food ever this week, and then a couple of weeks ago they're causing, you know, cancer or whatever. It's the same with exercise. Go run your all-out 30-second intervals to get your best cardiovascular, you know, workout. And then a month later, they're saying, no, jog really freaking slow. Don't do that hard stuff. When if we just conveyed, hey, everything kind of works. You need a little spice of this. This is what this fast stuff does. This is what this slow stuff does. We need all of it in the right amount. We'd be better off and people wouldn't lose their minds and, you know, grab onto trends.
There's more information out there than ever about how to be healthy, fit, well. There's more, I'm using scare quotes, experts. There is more access and avenues to exercise in the way you want than ever before. And I think people are more confused than they've ever been before. And I know those two things sort of go hand in hand, but I guess I'm just curious, like, how do you guys think we got here, and why is it that we overcomplicate everything?
Here's what I think about this. There's a lot going on. The first thing is that people want to feel good and perform well and live a long time. So there is an enormous market for advice on exercise and fitness. We've written about it before in the newsletter, but this goes all the way back to the Fountain of Youth. Right? People would go on this voyage to get this special water if it's going to help them live forever. There's always been an elixir related to longevity, health, performance, youth, fitness, you name it. The second thing is to use one of our exercise haikus. Now, move your body often, sometimes hard, every bit counts. Or just keep moving with sprinkle in some intensity, take one rest day, whatever all these things are. And I think for someone that is an exercise elitist, those are great. They make sense. But I think for a novice, those things are just way too broad. Like, they're meaningless. Mm. And I think what ends up happening is people want some specificity. They want to be told what to do. They want you to tell them, hey, do this at this heart rate for this amount of time. And what's happened is now there's been a proliferation of various protocols and approaches and routines. And everybody claims that theirs is the best because that's how you compete for attention. When, to quote Steve, like, they all probably work and they all probably don't work. It depends on what you're trying to do. So I think the end result is just like overwhelm and noise. But then maybe where sometimes we fail or we fall short is we come in there and we're like, just move your body every day, sometimes hard. And again, to someone that's gone through the complexity, that has lived as an athlete or that has been on the path of fitness for years, that immediately makes sense. But if you say that to a newbie, they're going to be like, thanks for nothing, man.
I mean, I think the other part of it that is in there is people want to differentiate themselves. You said it yourself, Clay, is there's so many experts, right? If I'm the only expert in the room, if I'm Arthur Lydiard writing in the 1970s and the only dude who's writing books about distance running, good. I can say, I can call it whatever I want. Like, I don't have to complicate it because people are going to look at me and read my book and say, I'm going to follow this plan or program because, like, there's not many resources. Now you go on Instagram and everybody and their mom is an influencer is going to tell you how to run or exercise or what have you. So what does that push us to do? To like find our niche, to make ourselves different. And often to make ourselves different, we complicate the hell out of it. Because it's like, oh, what happens if you don't know anything, or you're novice, or you're not on the inside? If you hear someone say complicated terms or fancy words that you don't know, you assume they know what they're talking about. And there's research on this, especially in the field of using fancy like neuroscience terms. If you use them, you're more believable, even if they're made up garbage. Because people think like, oh, it's complicated. They must know what they're talking about. So I think there's also that is, as we move to social media where everyone has a voice and a platform, it kind of proliferated people kind of wanting to make a name for themselves.
But even for the exercise elitists, like all this jargon makes someone like me, who I consider myself well-informed on this stuff, feel like I'm behind. Like I saw an article yesterday on GQ about VO2 max. I will admit that I have no idea. Well, I shouldn't say no idea, but I don't really know what VO2 max is. And as I said earlier, like I'm a pretty decent civilian runner. I can run like a low 5 minute mile, but I couldn't tell you what VO2 max is. But I see an article like that, and I'm like, should I know what VO2 max is? It creates this sense of urgency and a sense of like almost information deficit.
Yeah, I mean that's what it's designed to do. I mean that's why people use jargon. Yeah. Because it confuses people, but it creates this like, oh, this person knows I need to learn this. Like, and what you generally say, and I'm going to sound super elitist here, and I'm sorry for that, listeners, don't hate me. But if I go to a talk or a presentation in the endurance world, and I start to see someone like just using all the jargon, VO2 max and all the zones and like, you know, going further, the metabolic pathways, 90 plus percent of the time, I know they're bullshitting because they're trying to convince you. The real experts know all that stuff. I can tell you all about VO2 max, but they know that like what matters and what doesn't. Mm. And for instance, like everybody screams about VO2 max, especially now because like it's tied to longevity. And the reason is because it's the simplest measure that we've measured for over 100 years in the endurance cap, you know, endurance world. So we have lots of data on it, right? So we can tie figures to, oh, people with long, bigger VO2 maxes live longer or healthier or what have you. If you did the same study and you tied it to mile time, I'm going to bet, you know, with very pretty good certainty that the correlation would be even stronger.
But grip strength is another one. Number of pushups that you can do. I mean, all of these things are essentially testing for like cardiovascular health and musculoskeletal stability, essentially, because we know that the two biggest killers, or I shouldn't say killers, but like what ends up happening is your cardiovascular system fails. That's VO2 max. And then you have frailty, you have falls. That's like muscular stability. And just because we are talking about it, on VO2 max, a couple of things. First, your ceiling is genetically determined.
What is VO2 max for those who may not know?
Isn't it just like the amount of oxygen that your body can use when it's working at its max?
Yeah, I mean, it's the maximum volume of oxygen that can flow through. So, I mean, we could get really complicated and it looks at, you know, how much we can utilize and all that stuff, but it basically is how much oxygen can you consume?
So then my next question is VO2 max, is the ceiling of VO2 max genetically determined?
Yeah.
And does VO2 max increase with training?
To a small degree, yes.
So then isn't the answer just to train?
It is. And this is why I should add a caveat. And this is why I love having this discussion. VO2 max increases when you go from a novice to well-trained. But once you're well-trained, doesn't change much. So there's this brilliant study from several years ago that looked at Paula Radcliffe, former marathon world record holder, you know, one of the best in the world, best in history during her time. And they tracked her VO2 max for something like, it was absurd, like 12, 13 years. And from the age of, I don't remember exactly, something like 19 to 33 or something, 34, didn't really change. Yet she got way faster, like way faster. Why? Because VO2 max, we kind of hit that genetic limit once we go from like haven't trained very much to like have trained a bit, you know, after a couple of years. And then once we've hit that limit, the other stuff that contributes to endurance performance, like running economy, you know, lactate threshold, this other stuff improves a lot more. It's more trainable. So you can train it for a much longer time. So this is also one of my pet peeves when people say like VO2 max. I'm like, why are you focusing on the thing that, like, you know, if you trained really hard for a couple of years would be maxed out, and then you're looking at minutia of improvement or none instead of this other stuff that we know you could train for literally decades if you needed to.
And can I try to bring this back to simplicity here too? So VO2 max, Clay, does not really matter at all for performance. And you're a great example of that because you're a 5 minute miler that hadn't really understood what VO2 max is until about 10 minutes ago. And you take the bet, you know, the random person for $1 million versus death. So we're going to assume you're a smart guy. You're a better runner than 99.99999% of people, including those that are online blabbing about VO2 max. That's the first thing. The second thing is zoning out of mechanistic exercise science and actually talking about something I know a thing or two about, public health. We know that things like VO2 max don't matter. If you really want to make things simple and you are concerned with health and longevity, we've said this a few times. We went on Derek Thompson's podcast, Plain English, to talk about this. There are really only a few things that matter. And I'm just going to tell them like they are. These are facts, not feelings. The first is that you don't smoke and you don't use tobacco products. The second is that you maintain low levels of body fatness. BMI, not the best measure if you're really muscular, but if you're not really muscular, BMI is probably pretty accurate. Number three, you are not an alcoholic. You use alcohol in moderation if you use it at all. Number four, you move your body regularly, doing things that elevate your heart rate from what it is when you're at rest. As Steve would say, most of the time you want to be able to have a conversation, but the conversation should sound a little bit like this. You should know I'm exercising. And number five, you should have friends. You should be involved in community. You should have other people around you. Study after study, millions of people included in these studies show that once you get rid of those five things, we cannot really trace any causality to any of these other things. Now, what's interesting is that if you do all those five things, your VO2 max is probably going to be in the upper proportion because you're exercising all the time, you're not fat, and your lungs aren't fried from smoking. So oftentimes the other mistake that we get is we find these mechanistic things that are actually byproducts of the main thing. And the main thing for health and longevity, it is those five things. And coming back full circle, I may be an exercise elitist, but the clients that I work with are not, but they're very well-educated, knowledgeable people. And if I were to tell them, you know, just let's take our elitist haiku, move your body often, sometimes hard, every day counts. They're like, Brad, this isn't what I pay you for. So you know what I tell them to do? Most of them can afford a treadmill. Actually, they all can. I work with very privileged people. I say, get a treadmill. And 5 days a week, set aside 40 minutes and start by setting that incline to three grade, and walk on it at a pace that gets you sweating. And let's do that for 2 weeks. And then let's up the grade to four, and let's up the grade to five. And after 6 months, without fail, their blood pressures all come down. They've all lost some weight. More importantly, they all feel great. Then about 70% of my clients, they just stay there and they add some weight. They increase the speed, they increase the incline. And for them, walking up a hill 5 days a week, that's all they'll need to do for the rest of their lives. And then 30%, they get the exercise bug. They want to talk about weightlifting. They want to talk about running. And I refer them to someone that actually knows what they're doing. But that's it. It's really that simple. And that to me is like the directive advice we should be giving. It shouldn't be about your lactate or your VO2 max or nose breathing. It should be get a treadmill and set the incline to four, or find a hill and jog up it and then walk down and do it 4 days a week and do it for a month and see how you feel.
I think there's another factor at play here with all of the sort of misinformation. I got this from a conversation with a woman. I hope I'm getting her name right. I think it's Natalia Petterzella, but she just wrote a book. I think it was called Fit Nation, but it's about the evolution of fitness and health in America. But she made a really interesting point when I talked to her a while ago about one problem that we don't really get a good base level physical education in this country. And in some ways, we actually get the wrong messages. I mean, definitely my fitness class, my PE class taught me that like running was punishment. That's not necessarily great. So a lot of people, if I put aside my exercise elitism right now, a lot of people don't have a base level understanding of fitness. And then nowadays, what they do if they want to get educated, they might go on Instagram. And what is the easiest proxy for is this person in good shape? Are they shredded? And so you go to, this person looks completely shredded. They must know what they're talking about. And I think that's also where that is a particular problem these days, that it's like, okay, well, I'm just going to look at who looks like they know what they're talking about. But a lot of people who really know what they're talking about may not have the look of someone who's, you know, using steroids, maybe got some EPO and is completely, absolutely shredded to the gills and 0% body fat.
What I would add there is P done right is really worth it. The problem is we haven't valued PE for a really long time. So actually, I'm going to tell you, if you go look at Greg Thompson, who was for a long time PE teacher in, I don't know, up north somewhere, what he does with his elementary to junior high kids is phenomenal. It's essentially, I've watched him present many times at Vern Gambetta's conference, another great coach. And it's like movement literacy for kids, like amazing. The problem is we don't have enough Gregs. And the reason is because we've devalued PE in school to make it seem more like kind of babysitting of kids to get them moving to like give the teachers a break. Or in middle and high school, we've made it the easy periods for the football coaches so that they can like have a break so they can plan and scheme for the practice and let these kids do laps around the, you know, around the track instead of teach them how to move. So I think I'm with you. I think we need to like return to our roots of what kind of PE started as, there's some great videos from the 50s and 60s of like actual physical education and teach people how to move.
Seems like we need like a presidential fitness test, but for adults. When you get your driver's license, you should have to do like the something updated, not the sit and reach and the push-up sit-ups. I mean, push-ups, I guess, is good, but man, sit and reach, what a joke that was.
I failed that every time, Clay. It's what prevented me. Bill Clinton and George Bush wouldn't give me their presidential fitness because of that damn sit and reach.
And I think it's just important to recognize too that, you know, yes, a fitness challenge like that for adults would be great, but broadly speaking, at a population level, you have to set adults up to have a chance for success. And while some of it is education and whatnot, a big part of it is access to physical activity, time for physical activity, time to purchase and prepare one's own meals, so on and so forth. I mean, I think that we underestimate how hard it is for people who might have to work two jobs or people who are single parents, just to freaking hold down the fort. Mm-hmm. And what do you do in those situations? Well, when you're stressed and you don't have time, you get something that is fast and easy and tasty. And if you live in North Carolina, like I do, on the way home from school, you pass by about 24 options to do that. And now you're eating that and now your kid's eating that. And like, that's, you know, the crisis in American public health is not zone 2 or circadian disorder. It's what I'm saying right now. It is a lack of time and knowledge about what is actually healthy and endless options to make the unhealthy choice. The unhealthy choice is always the easy choice. And that's what's driving poor health in America.
And I think it's also, to piggyback on that, is we've bastardized movement by eliminating parks, places to walk, easy access to where you can exercise for free, even access to tracks. I can tell you this as a runner, often all the high school tracks are, you know, gated, so you have to hop the fence to use them. Not suggesting that you do that, but we've kind of bastardized it so that people think they have to, you know, get a gym membership, which they can't afford to exercise because there are no parks or easy access to kind of do stuff. And I think that's one place that, or one area where if you look at certain Scandinavian countries and European countries, they do a lot better of just access for everyone to move or ride a bike or take a walk, which we do a piss poor job of.
Yeah. And this happens in everything, right? At the population level, the solution is not in any influencer or not in any mechanistic exercise science. It's in public and population health. And then for the well-off educated people with some time and income, the solution is also not in mechanistic, overcomplicated, complex influencers on the internet. It's in getting that treadmill and setting the incline to 3%. Or doing whatever the equivalent is for you and doing it regularly and consistently.
I think that is a great way to cap this off. If you guys want to take the New York Times quiz, potentially be as enraged by it as we were, please look in the show notes. It will be there. If you are Grant Fisher, I'm only 90% sure that's even his name. We apologize for offending you and blaspheming your name. Don't blame Steve. Blame me and Brad.
I'm not taking the bet, Grant, so you can't come after me. My life is safe.
One last thing I want to do here, and maybe I shouldn't admit to this because I don't know what it says, but no one is calling our voicemail. I have gotten some very nice emails from people, and I really appreciate that. If you want to email me, it's clay.growtheq@gmail.com. No one's calling our voicemail. It is 646-893-9503. So if you're still listening and you call our voicemail, whoever asks the best question that you want answered on this show, and yes, best is subjective, I will Venmo you $20. I will text you, I will get your Venmo, and I will send you $20. So please call. I just want some voicemails. I want some listener participation here. And I want to see if people are even listening this far into the show. So it's been a bit of a double experiment. 646-893-9503. We just spent a whole episode talking about how scams are bad. This is not a scam. I will send you $20 if you ask a question that makes it into the show. If you've made it this far, thank you for listening. Thanks for sharing your time with us. Thanks for putting up with us. We appreciate it. And we will talk to you on Monday. Until then, farewell.